What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Joshua Clark Davis. Joshua Clark Davis is an associate professor of history at the University of Baltimore. He's the author of From Head Shops to Whole Foods and the co-editor of Baltimore Revisited. He's also written for The Nation, Slate, Jacobin, and The Atlantic. His book that we're discussing today, along with some other tings, is Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle, and the Activists Who Fought Back. Welcome to the show, Josh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Kat. Thanks for having me.
I was really fascinated by this. I talk a lot, as you can imagine, about law enforcement and spend a lot of time rooted in history. And one of the things, the points that you make in the book that I really appreciated was that the FBI sort of gets all of the credit for the horrific things that happen to activists during the civil rights movement, as well as the Black Power movement, oftentimes ignoring the role of local police. I bring that up a lot when I talk about the assassination of Chairman Fred Hampton. That there was actually, you know, this collusion between the two law enforcement entities. So I want to start actually by asking you, what is the mainstream narrative about which law enforcement agency, the FBI, was primarily responsible for attacking the civil rights movement, and why is that not necessarily accurate?
Yeah, that's a great question to start with. I think, so the book is called Police Against the Movement. I really wanted to retell and rethink the story of the civil rights struggle of the 1960s through that movement's work against police violence. And on the flip side, I wanted to rethink how we conceive of what police did to the civil rights movement. I think some of the most iconic moments of the civil rights movement, unfortunately, have been these just horrific moments of police violence against civil rights activists from Birmingham, Alabama, Bull Connor sicking his henchmen on Black children who were protesting with German shepherds with fire hoses, or protesters marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, in Selma being attacked by Alabama state troopers. And that's not to say those were not horrific things and that they were not important things, but I think what has happened is that the narrative that has become most prevalent is that police violence is something that happened to the civil rights movement and not something that the civil rights movement resisted. It's that civil rights activists were victims of police violence without pushing back against it. And connected to all of that, the narrative is local police basically did the really most crude, brutal things that could be caught on camera because they were kind of thick-headed and didn't really have much strategic vision. Whereas, you know, the mastermind of destroying movements was J. Edgar Hoover, and that the surveillance, the sophisticated slander, all of that stuff was coming from the feds, and that the police were kind of trailing behind the feds to keep up. Whereas I'm arguing local police across the country were doing all kinds of sophisticated things, infiltration, surveillance, slander against the civil rights movement, even before things like the COINTELPRO against so-called Black extremists is launched in 1967. Local police are doing that stuff years before that COINTELPRO is launched. And so we have to bring local police repression of the civil rights movement back into the middle of the narrative.
One of the points that you make in terms of the difference between law enforcement agencies was about resources and staffing, and who was actually able to dedicate resources, and also who was more equipped to infiltrate organizations based on skin color, who was actually employed at these agencies. I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, this kind of prefigures our current moment where, you know, police departments all over the country are falling over themselves on Martin Luther King's birthday on Juneteenth to kind of establish themselves as quote unquote diverse employers who value inclusion. And I think sometimes there's a mistaken idea that there weren't really Black police officers yet by the 1960s. And whereas that is true in some places like Birmingham, Alabama, It's not true of most major cities across the country. And most Black police officers were getting into the line of work, for middle class jobs and because those positions were respected in their communities. And they often were assigned to work Black communities. A lot of white officers didn't want to work in Black communities, to be honest. And Black officers were thinking of themselves as, if I am someone who grew up in Harlem, why not also work in that community? And that describes, many Black police officers at the time. But you had these red squads across the country and police departments. They are secret political intelligence units. And in the mid 1960s, early 1960s, they are infiltrating in a number of cities, civil rights groups. And they aren't really confident that they can send white guys into Black-led activist groups, right? And so they're very eager to hire the occasional Black officer who is comfortable infiltrating a civil rights group. We know about this with the FBI, but one key difference is that the FBI really hired informants on the other, like, in other words, the FBI barely had any Black agents at all, and the FBI really preferred to like hire someone on the outside, not to send their own agents in. I'm not saying that's better, but what I'm saying is that police departments like the NYPD, the LAPD, the Houston PD would send their own officers to take on fake names and go into civil rights groups. And that's an important story to remember and know, again, that it wasn't just the feds doing that, and that harmed a lot of local activist groups in different cities, so much so that by the early 1970s, some of the national Black police officer associations began to speak out about the practice. They began to pass resolutions at their conferences to say, we're tired of white superiors in intelligence units ordering newly hired Black officers to infiltrate groups and to work against their own community.
You said something that I want to unpack. This both connected to another point that you make, but I also just think is important in the conversation about Black folks and policing in general. And that is, I talk a lot about the cognitive dissonance around policing for Black communities, right? That on the one hand, we're told this is the entity that's going to keep us safe. This is who you call for help. And then on the other hand, the lived experience is brutality. Racial profiling, abuse, living in communities with occupied armies. And so you just said, right, that these jobs are respected in the communities, but you also make the point in the introduction that police violence was an issue easy to galvanize the Black community around because of the daily lived experience of police violence against Black bodies.
Right. I think, again, this is something that we totally leave out of the way that we have told the civil rights movement's history. I think, part of how I came to this idea was 10 plus years ago, right, when the movement for Black lives is really rising and cresting across this country, media across the country and outside spectators were saying, oh, look, this new movement is picking up where the civil rights movement ended. This new movement is finally addressing the unfinished work of the civil rights movement. Now, BLM organizers, they did not say that, but the prevailing media narrative was, hey, this new movement is doing something the civil rights movement did not do. And I really wanted to refute that false narrative in my book. I mean, I didn't start from that position. I started from the position of, hey, I'm wondering, what did the civil rights movement say and do against police violence? I know that they endured a lot of it. I know that it came up from time to time, like at the March on Washington, but what else did they do? And so, what kind of became apparent in a lot of my research was that many different civil rights organizers in the early and mid 60s were doing things like picketing police stations, even doing things like sit-ins inside police stations, holding rallies, doing marches. Now, one of the things that's important to say is that in a lot of the rural South and the most draconian parts of the South, like Birmingham, Alabama, Black organizers are really just, in a sense, fighting for their lives and fighting to protect themselves. And protesting the police is kind of one of the third rails, so to speak. And so many of them are very careful about doing that. What I saw more often is that in the large cities of the South, and also in the cities of the North and the West, like you were just saying, Kat, police violence was something that really, really galvanized Black communities. And some of the leading civil rights groups, like SNCC, like CORE, were kind of trailing behind Black communities at first. And they're listening to communities like good organizers do and saying, hey, these communities are sick and tired of police violence. We've known that, but we're hearing them saying it even more forcefully. We need to start organizing around this issue. So it's a group like the Congress of Racial Equality in 1963, after the Birmingham police brutally attacked Black school children on national TV, where CORE nationally says, this is not just an issue in Birmingham, this is nationwide. We need to start organizing around this, all of our national chapters.
So many follow-up questions to things you said. So I'm trying to figure out like which order to go in first. But I think since we ended, you ended with CORE. I want to dig a little bit deeper into the work of SNCC and CORE in the 60s that directly confronted police violence. Start by talking a little bit actually about the theory of police malpractice.
Right. So, just as a refresher, I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with kind of the big four civil rights groups of the 1960s. There was the NAACP, which was arguably the most moderate kind of liberal group. There was the Southern Christian Liberal
Still.
Conference. Okay. SCLC, which was Dr. King's group. And yeah, some of these things are still happening. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. SNCC, which was really the shock troops of the movement, the only youth-led movement, a more radical Black-led movement. And then the fourth one is really the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, which is not of the four, it's the least remembered today. If people remember them, they usually recall them as, oh yeah, those are the people who kicked off the Freedom Rides. But what I really found through my research was that it was CORE of the four groups that was pushing the fight against police violence most aggressively, especially in the early 60s. And what they did that was very smart and I think ahead of their time in a lot of ways is they saw the brutality of Birmingham, Alabama. They saw the terrible things happening in the Deep South. They saw the physical attacks, but they, as an organization, developed this theory of police malpractice. And there was this organizer named Alan Gartner. And he basically developed this theory that said, yes, police hurt people with billy clubs, with guns. They beat them. They even, in some cases, kill them. But there's this whole array of violence. It's malpractice that they are doing. It could be false arrests. It could be, trumped up felony indictments as a form of revenge. It could be people getting, police officers getting people fired from their jobs. It's this whole array of things that are totally antithetical to what police's stated job duties are. And so he said, this is police malpractice. And so CORE was kind of pushing this theory, and it was a national organization based in New York, but they had 50 chapters all over the country. Including in LA, including in San Francisco, including in Seattle and Philly and a whole bunch of cities. And they were really encouraging their local chapters, watch out for police violence. When someone is beaten by the police, hold a rally, go to the station, demand a meeting, but also track these other forms of malpractice, these legal forms of violence, these forms of slow violence. They take place gradually over time. They can't necessarily be captured on camera. They aren't someone getting their skull cracked, but they are another form of law enforcement doing tremendous harm to citizens, and especially to Black citizens, and especially to people who are involved in these movements.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Josh Davis. He's got a book out called Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back. So his theory of police malpractice, which I really appreciate because we talk about now in the movement often, right? Like the most visible form of police violence or state terror is when they murder one of us. That's what gets all the attention. But there's all these other ways from, occupying our communities, like their armies, to racial profiling, to rape, to, I mean, it just, the list goes on and on and on. How did CORE use this theory of police malpractice as an organizing tactic in or a framework for pushing forward the work of the civil rights movement?
I think what CORE was doing was saying that, yes, physical violence is a real problem, but they were recognizing that, especially in the quote unquote liberal North and the so-called progressive cities of the West, that a Boston police department or a San Francisco police department, that they were not typically okay with being caught attacking people on camera on national TV. Yes, there are some police departments that did that. Chicago PD did that notoriously during the Democratic National Convention in 1968. But typically, a lot of police looked at what Bull Connor's police officers in Birmingham, Alabama did and said, hey, they messed up. That's bad PR. They made themselves look bad. They made us look bad. CORE was basically saying we have to organize with a longer view to the quieter, more sophisticated ways that law enforcement can hurt our movement and also hurt communities of color. And I think it was like an organizing principle around the idea that violence can be legal. And it was a way of trying to get people to expand their notion of the harm that the state can do against citizens and against people. And I think what happened was that CORE planted these seeds, and SNCC really picked that up a few years later, where SNCC by the mid 60s is really kind of expanding this framework and saying, hey, this is not only violence against Black people of a legal nature, but it is state repression of movements. And in many ways, SNCC was already beginning to think about this type of state repression as, if not actual fascism, proto-fascism, right? Kind of seeing that the seed bed of fascism was state repression against movements, and not just physical, but legal, reputational, technological.
Not just police departments in the North, but communities, white communities in the North, really important to even today, with the spread of this conversation and fighting against state terror, very important to differentiate themselves from the South, right? Well, we're not like them. It's better here. Can you talk about the mythology of racism in police departments? I mean, you can go generally if you'd like, but the book is about police departments in the North not being as racist, as violent, as horrific as those in the South, and why actually that mythology is important to blow up in order to further the civil rights movement, and I would say the Black Power movement, and I would say to get us to the conversation we're having today. This had to be a uniform conversation about the institution of policing as a whole, regardless of demographic location of the department.
Exactly. I mean, so historians in the last 10, 15, 20 years have really made huge strides in kind of deflating this mythical narrative that the civil rights movement was a Southern movement. And they've really pushed far ahead and showing, no, it was a Southern movement and a Northern movement and a Western movement. It was a national movement. Now, that doesn't mean that kind of our public consciousness in 2025 recognizes it that way. It seems like most people in our country, unfortunately, still think of the civil rights movement as a Southern movement that was confronting a Southern problem. And so I wanted to really write a national book. If, the civil rights movement was national because racism was a national problem. If I'm going to write a book about how the civil rights movement addresses police violence, it's not because it was a Southern problem, it's because it was a national problem. And I think there were a lot of liberals, mostly white liberals, who were justifiably horrified by what they saw, happening in Birmingham and Selma and other places. But they often clung to the notion that this is another part of the country. This is happening somewhere else. This is the vestige of an old system, a region that's been, fallen behind the times. And even white liberals who were willing to maybe even join the civil rights movement, for many of them, the idea was, I'm going somewhere else to fight a problem somewhere else. And that many of them were missing out on the civil rights movement happening in their own backyards. And so I think this is so important in terms of police violence, because exactly as you said, police violence was happening everywhere. And it was especially Black communities in the North and the West who I think felt empowered enough to confront it head on. It's not that they didn't do that in the South. It's just that in some of the rural South and some of the most draconian parts of the South, that local law enforcement were murdering people and doing it with even greater impunity than they could in other northern cities. So it was kind of about, how much are northern police departments worried about their reputation? How much are they worried about bad PR? They might be doing acts of violence, but they hypothetically don't want to be caught doing them. Whereas in Alabama, a lot of law enforcement just, justified it by saying we're defending segregation. But yes, this was a national movement, and if we rethink of civil rights movement as a national movement, especially this movement against police violence, it changes how we think of the civil rights struggle, not as something that was the South's problem, but America's problem, and one that continues today.
Josh Davis, we could do a whole segment on what I'm about to ask you about next, but I mean, we will at some point because I think it's an important conversation to have, pros, cons, and how it manifests in the current moment. And that is your assertion that having the conversation that we're having brings communism and socialism and those activists back into the center of the movement. I think it's a critical piece of the conversation that's often forgotten. So I want to give you some time to unpack what I just said and what was the reality, right? And how I hope my listeners a little bit how a lot of what happened to Black communities, right? The targets and the strategies, et cetera, the databases that was born out of, right? The Red Scare tactics and attacks on communists and socialists. My favorite plays on the planet that I when I was much younger had the opportunity to do Scottsboro Boys, and I think that like captures. Right, some of that interplay in a really beautiful way. So, for folks that haven't read that play, read it. Let me stop talking now and allow you to address that.
I mean, great question. And 100%, yeah, a case like the Scottsboro Boys does really reflect the dynamic I was trying to point to, which was avowed Marxists, socialists, especially communists in the 20s and especially in the 30s and 40s, pre-Red Scare, were really the leading political formation in this country to identify, confront, and resist police violence, and to make police violence a major issue. They weren't the only one, but they were the ones who were, like, I would say, the vanguard of identifying police violence as a critical problem affecting communities of color. These are both white and Black communists. I'm sure some of your listeners know the document We Charge Genocide that was written by the Civil Rights Congress, which was from 1951, I believe. And it was a document written almost entirely by Black communists, including people like Paul Robeson, like William Patterson, many others. And they issued a petition to the United Nations and said, the United States of America is committing genocide against African Americans. They pointed out correctly that doesn't mean necessarily that the government is trying to eliminate all African Americans, but that they are carrying out a systematic campaign in various localities, municipalities, states, and on a federal level against Black people with the intent of killing quite a few of them off. And notoriously, it's remembered that, they pointed to things like lynching, of course. But also, what's forgotten is that they really talked about police violence and how police were killing black people throughout the country. And they documented it in a very forensic way. It's kind of a gruesome document because, in many ways, it's talking about very terrible cases of state violence. But they also, communists were talking about FBI surveillance before almost any group was doing. They were doing that in the 40s. They're also talking about these red squads, these secret political police units that are aimed at radicals and at subversives and trying to destroy them. And so the Red Scare obviously kills most of the Communist Party, not all of it. Most socialists weather the movement, although they kind of step back from public life as well. And so in the 60s, especially the NAACP, especially the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were very, very sensitive about being denounced as communists. NAACP in particular was very, very anti-communist. And this movement against police violence in particular, lots of people, white authorities and police charged that it was a particularly communist plot. Hey, if you are denouncing the agents of the state, then that means you're anti-American, which means that you are communist. And so it kind of became this radioactive movement in the 50s, not just communism, but this movement against police violence. Fast forward to the 60s, the civil rights movement, in most cases, is keeping communists at bay. But more radical groups like SNCC and CORE, they didn't necessarily have communist members, but they were open to listening to communists. They were opening to working with them. They are shaped some by them, especially also by socialists. And they are listening to state, they're listening to Marxist theories of state violence in a way that the NAACP and SCLC aren't. And so they're not like announcing that loudly because they don't want to be charged as, radical subversives or communists, but they're in conversation with these groups. And if you look at the civil rights movement, most of the people who are organizing against police violence, most of them were in conversation with leftists. Most of them maybe had been a socialist at one point, or had friends who were communists, or just conversant in some of those theories, and not just saying, hey, anti-communism has to be a hallmark of our movement in a way that the NAACP really did.
I'm just gonna say it out loud because I can. Because people today, oftentimes are surprised at some of the stances that the NAACP takes. And right now, I'm talking locally, though this happened. I mean, we saw it in Ferguson, which is why those young people came up with the slogan, right? This isn't your grandparents' civil rights movement, which I struggle with a little bit because I think we should be specific about which grandparents, that we're talking about, and the ways in which the NAACP pushed back against defund, which said to reallocate dollars from the police department to give it to things that actually keep us safe. Proximity to power and moderation has always been the political praxis of the NAACP. Forever and always, amen. And that has not changed. In fact, it's evolved and gotten worse. You don't necessarily have to respond to that unless you want to, but I had to get that out of my mouth.
Well, I mean, what I will say briefly is that, the NAACP did at different points do important work against police violence, especially like in the 30s and 40s, at a time when communists were still accepted in the country. But, once that cause of fighting police violence got kind of tarred and feathered as a communist cause, the NAACP moved away from protesting police violence, moved away from rallies and direct action, kind of limited themselves to a very legalistic approach. Yes, they were filing civil rights cases in some of the most gruesome instances of police violence, but they basically thought that's not something we should be doing on the street. And so I talked about Ella Baker in the book because Ella Baker had been a member of the New York NAACP, and she was very eager to organize a whole campaign against police violence for the NAACP in New York in 1953. And the NYPD and the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association really kind of beat the campaign back by denouncing it as a communist campaign. And the national leadership, I think, it's really shook by these attacks. I mean, the NAACP also was the civil rights organization that was most eager to say, we're not just non-communist, we're anti-communist. And things have come out over the years about how the NAACP wanted to curry favor with someone like J. Edgar Hoover. And I believe it was the case that, I had heard this quote by J. Edgar Hoover and from the earlier mid-50s, where he really praises the NAACP and really, glowingly speaks about them as a non-subversive organization. And if I'm remembering this correctly, some of that was because then NAACP chairman Walter White, and maybe it was also Roy Wilkins, I believe they solicited that endorsement from the FBI. And in a sense, they really wanted not only to be anti-communist, but they were proud. They wanted to be recognized as anti-communist. And they were also quite happy with that endorsement from Hoover. That doesn't mean they knew what Hoover was doing. I don't think they did really, but they kind of got duped and or allowed themselves to be used in a way to protect themselves politically. It's a complicated legacy, but yeah, it's documented. It's we could find the historical sources that show that relationship.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Josh Davis. He's got a book out called Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back. I talk a lot about, and not just I, other organizers and advocates that are in this conversation in this moment about the importance of understanding our history, right? And the importance of being rooted in political education. You cannot adequately organize in the present if you are not pulling on the lessons. Like even the conversation we just had, you cannot understand the positionality of NAACP right now if you don't understand the positionality of the NAACP historically, right? Otherwise you're just outraged and mad as opposed to going, oh, well, that makes sense. Two-part question for you, Josh. You say that you think that there are some people that are not happy, or you got the feeling as you were writing this book that there are people who were not happy about you telling this story. You can do it generally, but who and why? What are you pushing on that people don't want you to push on? And why is this part of our history important to lift up in this current moment where we've had 17 years? I'm going to push back on when you say it started, because it didn't start with BLM. Started in 2009, in my hometown. But that said, 17 years, longest sustained period focused on the issue of police violence in the history of this country. Why do we need to understand what's happening in the 60s to adequately organize in 2025?
Okay, big question. So, first part, I didn't realize this when I started the book, but the book, by the time I finished it, I realized that this book was a whole lot about memory and not just about how the civil rights movement is remembered, but in particular, how police tell or more often don't tell their story of their connection and their attacks on the civil rights movement. I mean, it's crazy to say this, but it's like, and I can't really account for the FBI in 2025, but, for whatever it's worth, someone like Jim Comey, he at the very least publicly acknowledged that the FBI spied on Martin Luther King. There is widespread public acknowledgement that COINTELPRO, as carried out by the FBI, sabotaged the Black Panthers, that it other FBI disruption campaigns attacked Martin Luther King. Unfortunately, the way we tell the story of state suppression and state repression in the civil rights movement, too often we fall into this battle of personalities. Oh, it's Hoover versus King. It's these two men duking it out. And we really are not looking at repression of the rank and file. We're not talking about especially how local police attack the movement. And local police are very content with that. They again will fall over themselves every January to praise Dr. King. But of course, I don't think any police department in the country has really acknowledged the ways in which it attacked the civil rights movement, maybe the one in Birmingham a little bit. And this isn't a shock, but if you look at police textbooks, if you go to the National Law Enforcement Museum in DC, They're actually playing kind of a sophisticated game. It's not as simplistic as one might think. They're basically saying, yeah, the 60s were a complicated time, and the FBI attacked the civil rights movement. Thank God Hoover passed away and was removed from power, and now things are okay. They are willing to even point to the FBI as those are the people who attacked the movement, not us. If local police across the country are unwilling to even acknowledge any of that history, how can they ever repair relations with Black communities? I don't think that if they acknowledge that history, that's going to wave some magic wand, but it's like you cannot claim to in any way want equality or racial justice if you cannot acknowledge the history of police violence and police sabotage of the civil rights movement. Now, and those are folks who I don't think they want that story. I don't think they love, you know, I published a story a few years ago about police surveillance at the March on Washington. That's supposedly the shining moment in self-correcting democracy, the I Have a Dream speech. Even Republicans today will cite that and try to weaponize that speech in attacking people. At that very rally, there were at least four different police departments surveilling King, not just the FBI, but New York Police Department surveilled people who were going to the March on Washington. Chicago PD surveilled people in Chicago trying to go to that march. Birmingham traveled to the march. A Philly police officer traveled to the march to watch, surveil,